Good morning, good evening, wherever you are, and welcome to episode 51 of the Cloudcast. As always, we're coming to you live from our massive Cloudcast studios here in Raleigh, North Carolina, but apologies for some background noise. We're doing some renovations on the studio. We're building a new green room and a new audience platform and doing some other things, and so you might hear some construction throughout today's podcast, so we apologize ahead of time.
trying to accommodate the massive crowds that like to come see the live show.
Exactly. So before we introduce today's guests, we just wanted to go back and quickly recap the first 50 shows. I wasn't able to actually make episode 50. I was heading off whitewater rafting with my daughter up in the mountains, so I didn't have service last week. But we just kind of wanted to take a few minutes and kind of give everyone a state of the podcast.
Good. So you don't actually want to recap every single show?
No.
Okay, good. Good.
I already have a feeling talking to Simon, the show may run a little long today. So I just wanted to say real quickly, just a huge thank you to all of the guests and co-hosts and friends of the show over the last year and a half. The amount of support we've received from the community has just been absolutely amazing. We kind of started this thing and we're like, hey, do you think anyone will actually come on the show? And we were surprised, right?
we were absolutely surprised because we literally would just ping people on Twitter and say, hey, we're doing this thing and we're nobodies and we have no audience, but would you like to come and listen and or come and talk? And it started slow, we've had fun with it. I think we've learned a lot. We've made a lot of friends, and that was kind of half the battle. I mean, that was what we really wanted to get out of it. And then the fact that people know about it and they want to be part of it is really, really cool. And, you know, hopefully we continue to provide stuff that people find useful and maybe want to tell a friend about.
Absolutely. So what else do you want to comment on before we get Simon on here?
So maybe a couple of things. So, you know, we've always said that we were going to stay independent. We tried to keep this outside of what we do on a regular basis, paying our bills. So I think we're still pretty committed to keeping this as independent and vendor biased as possible. I think people like that. It gives them a chance to, you know, hear different perspectives on cloud computing. They don't feel like it's marketing. So I think we're really, really committed to that. And, I think there's a lot of areas that we still need to explore. So, not only explore, but, you know, this stuff's changing all the time. So we'll come back to things that maybe we talked about a year ago. So, you know, for folks that maybe don't like repetition, we'll try not to make it too frequently. But there's times when companies change and strategies change and technologies change. So, our promise is to keep it fresh. I feel good that we finally figured out how to schedule this show. Because we were terrible for the longest time.
Yeah,
so
that was far and away the biggest challenge we've ever overcome. More than any technology challenge or anything else, it was just simply how to get everyone on Skype at the same time.
Yeah, so pretty much we do these things Thursday nights. We try and keep them published on Friday. We give you something to listen to on the weekend when you're, you know, doing whatever you do in your regular life. So we're committed to doing that. We're gonna try and take the show on the road to a few events when we get a chance to get out there, like VMworld next week. We'll be out there doing some live shows. So, maybe my biggest thing is if you want to be part of the show, if you'd like to participate, whether it's questions or you want to be a guest or whatever, we're always looking for smart people. You know, like we always say, people smarter than you and I, which is a low barrier. And let's keep the show kind of community based. Let's keep it fun and let's keep it educational.
Yep. And please keep the feedback coming. We have received a lot of emails about feedback and things we could improve on or potential guests or potential questions for guests. And so the email address is on the website, but it is show@thecloudcast.net. And we would love to hear from you as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So enough of us rambling. Why don't we get to our guests? Because this is going to be kind of a heavy show. Lots of deep thinking going on. Okay, and we're back, and today's guest is really somebody we're interested in talking to, somebody that we've been following for a long time, so we want to welcome Simon Wardley all the way over from the UK. Simon, welcome aboard.
Thank you very much.
So you've got a very interesting background. For folks that maybe don't know you or haven't kept up with all the things that you do in research and writing, give us a real quick brief background on what you do and where your focus is these days.
So background on myself, I used to be the CEO of a software company, a subsidiary of Canon. I was heavily involved in building platform as a service offerings back in 2005. We run our own internal, what is today called a private cloud, back around 2004. I got sort of heavily involved in the scene as it was developing. Later on, I ran strategy for Ubuntu for Canonical in terms of its movement into the cloud as well. Most of my stuff, the research that I do today, comes from my experiences during that time and models that I developed to explain how things change. Because being a CEO of a software company, you're competing against others, and it's very useful to understand the economics of change and how industries and environment changes, because that way you can look to means of exploiting it. And that is actually what I do today. So it's research which was born out of practice, and these days I refine and develop those models based upon the changes occurring in industry, and I teach companies how to fight other companies.
Yes. There you go. Very cool. And Simon, let me just also a quick plug for you as well. We'll put it in the show notes, but your OSCON talks from 2009, 2010, just great topics. And as far as I'm concerned, kind of like required viewing for everyone out there. So just wanted to let you know about that as well. And of course, we'll put them in the show notes.
Well, thank you very much. There's also one from 2007, which goes through many of the changes which we call cloud computing today. Obviously, I'm a terrible plagiarist. The whole industry of cloud, of the shift to utility computing, was written about by a chap called Douglas Parkhill in a wonderful 1966 book called The Challenge of the Computer Utility, where he made the analogy between computing and electricity and talked about this future of giant compute utilities, whether infrastructure, whether applications or whether platforms, talked about public and private compute utilities and government utilities and how it was going to change everything. So I'm always delighted when people say nice things about my presentations. Who isn't? Particularly the kittens and guns, which are a particular favorite of mine. But I have no doubt that my work is based upon much better minds than me.
So let's sort of jump into this. So you've got an interesting title, or at least one that you publish. You know, researcher, organizational warfare and evolution. For Leading Edge Forum. And you know, you've mentioned a number of times that, at least within the technology world, the IT technology world, we're sort of in a state of war, which is sort of different from what you call peacetime. And you know, we don't want to offend anybody who's in the military, but can you kind of elaborate what you mean when you say we're in, you know, wartime versus peacetime? And then more importantly, you know, now that we're in wartime, are there any rules, or are we just totally making up the rules as we go as an IT industry perspective?
Okay, so can I elaborate? The short answer is no. The long answer is naturally going to be longer. So in order to understand this, we have to start with some very, very basic principles. So first of all, most people are familiar with the concept of diffusion, so how things spread from early adopters all the way to laggards. That was a wonderful piece of work by Everett Rogers, which was much later made famous by Geoffrey Moore in his book Crossing the Chasm. Mm-hmm. Now, things diffuse, but diffusion doesn't explain evolution. It doesn't explain how things change. And by that I mean, for example, the first batteries were Parthian batteries around about 300 AD, and of course they spread and people use those for sort of electroplating, or what we believe that's what they were using them for. And of course the mechanism of provision of electricity evolved over time, and then you suddenly got things like small generators and bigger generators, and eventually Westinghouse and Tesla introduced the concepts of utility service provision, or modern utility service provision. We often say it was Edison, but there's a long history there, and I think it's fair to say it was Westinghouse and Tesla. But the point about this is that there is a process by which things evolve, which is different from the process of diffusion. So, you know, a new phone feature on a phone diffuses, but phones themselves evolve over time. And so the process of evolution turns out to be fairly common. And it's a process by which you get the genesis of some sort of activity, some new thing, some new need. Then you get custom-built examples of it. Then you get products, often with rental services. And then you get commodity and utility service provision. And that impacts all business activities. Now, what's interesting is that as things evolve and become more of a commodity, they enable higher order systems to appear. And so if you go back in time, you know, the nut and bolt, the Maudsley introduced the screw cutting lathe, they became more commodity. That enabled things like, you know, more complex machinery to appear. And electricity, as it evolved and became provided as a utility service, that enabled things like teletyping, radio, Hollywood to appear. So you get this constant process of things evolve, enabling higher order systems to appear. And it's almost like a loop, a cycle. So it's never the genesis, or what we loosely call innovation, of something which changes the world. It's always commoditization of pre-existing activities, which causes an explosion of growth of new higher order systems and what we call an age of wonder. Now, the...
Brian, did I lose you?
Yeah, no, we're still here.
So the economy goes through multiple sort of waves, or we call them quadratic waves, or you can call them ages. So you have like the industrial age, mechanical age, the age of electricity, etc. Each driven by the commoditization of something which previously existed. Each of those ages have what have basic eras. And these eras are as follows. You get a peace era. And a peace era is one of relative competition between companies, where sustaining change tends to exceed disruptive change. It's a time of very high profitability. And the activity itself starts to commoditize. But the companies who've been competing have huge inertia to that change because of past success. And so what happens is new companies come in and they initiate a state of war, a disruption of past industries stuck behind inertia barriers through the commoditization of a pre-existing activity. And then after that, you get an explosion of growth of new higher order systems. And that cycle of sort of peace, war, and then building growth and wonder constantly repeats in each of these eras. And every time we get it, we also get explosions in what are known as unmodeled data and endless arguments over classification. And so when you look at something like cloud computing, which is fundamentally about the commoditization of a range of activities in IT, a shift from products to more utility services, we're seeing a shift of certain industries from a sort of peace mentality, relative competition, sustaining change, exceeding in general disruptive change, to this war phase where new entrants have come in. So it wasn't the hosting markets, it was Amazon who came in, commoditize that particular activity, and the explosion of growth in new higher order systems, so things built on Amazon, as well as explosions in unmodeled data, and hence things like big data, etc. Mm-hmm. And that's perfectly normal. Now, any organization is a mass of activities, all at different stages of evolution, some in states of peace, some in states of build, some in states of war. Each of these areas require different methodologies, different techniques, and different strategies to effectively deal with them. Unfortunately, what happens is we like one size fits all, so we generally end up trying to apply single methods across the whole lot. And so classic examples of that, things like project management, we end up having religious debates over Agile versus Six Sigma, where in reality, some activities are suitable for Agile, some are suitable for Six Sigma, and the answer is not one or the other, it's both, and applying the right methodology to the evolves to an activity in the right state. And it's the same with strategy. So in the peace phase, it's all about profitability, increasing your margin. In the war phase, it's all about disruption of pre-existing industries, so commoditization. And the growth phase is all about experimentation, discovery of new things.
Gotcha. And that's sort of core to the talk you gave in 2009. I think it lays that out very, very well. So
thank you.
Good. So for folks that are, potentially looking at something like cloud computing and maybe sort of initially might be scared because of, like you said, this disruption, I think what you always tend to go back to is this isn't unique to the IT industry. This is sort of historically happens in all industries, whether it's manufacturing and automotive or whether it's something else. So it's really more wrapping your brain around, okay, how far into disruption are we? What are the opportunities, like you said, for experimentation, for being part of that sort of exploding growth phase afterwards? Is that fair?
Yes. So now inertia is an interesting one here, and concerns about change because. As an activity commoditizes, crosses, say, from that product, that rental product stage to more commodity and utility services, it's not only vendors who previously provided products who have inertia to change, and because they have all the data to say how they've been successful in the past, and they sort of believe that that's going to continue on into the future. But customers have inertia to the change as well. And that's because it's not just activities that evolve, but practices, they evolve as well. And they evolve through a very similar pattern from sort of novel emerging good to best practice, which mimics the whole Genesis custom built product and commodity change. And what happens is that we, for example, if I take infrastructure, because it's a very simple example, if we think about infrastructure when it was a product, practices developed for things like scaling and resilience, architectural practices, which spread and became best practice for a product world. And these were things like scale up bigger machines and N plus one for resilience. And what happens is as an activity evolves, novel practices emerge, which are designed for that new phase of that activity. So for infrastructure, it was things like distributed systems and design for failure, and they eventually spread and become best practice for that utility world. And it's that difference between the best practice for a product world and best practice for a utility world, which often helps create inertia for customers, because they've built lots of things on top of it based upon the past best practice. And of course, they have to re-architect. And that incurs a cost, and they try to avoid that sort of cost, which is why they have inertia to change as well. But it's unavoidable.
Sure. And so this idea of really moving from a product mentality to a utility mentality. So recently you stated, in order for new cloud providers or even existing cloud providers to really thrive, they would probably need to invest somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 million a year, I think is what the number was. And what does this mean for existing service providers, new service providers, and just what I also see it as is, way, 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 way back when in the dial-up days, it was the equivalent of I had a local ISP. And I would dial in on my 2400 or 9600 baud modem into my local ISP, and a lot of people had local ISPs, but then those eventually got merged into the AOLs of the world and all of these other big ISPs until you eventually only had a couple left. And do you see that happening again with cloud providers in the future?
So there's a couple of things here. We shouldn't confuse commoditization with centralization. The reason being is things can commoditize to a uniform standard interface, but they don't necessarily have to go to a single provider. You can get a distributed environment providing that service, as in a competitive market. There's a bunch of other economic constraints which generally tend towards one or another of those, but we shouldn't automatically confuse commoditization with centralization. Now, in terms of investment amounts and $500 million or thereabouts, when I RAND strategy for Ubuntu, getting Ubuntu into the cloud. This was in 2008. And in 2008, it was pretty easy for a relatively low amount of money for Ubuntu to become dominant in terms of the operating system most heavily used in that cloud space. And so I think even today, Ubuntu is probably the most commonly used operating system on Amazon and also Rackspace, and most of major sort of cloud projects build, like things like Cloud Foundry from VMware, build on Ubuntu. Now, that's a much easier game than against, say, Red Hat or Microsoft as a competitors, than Ubuntu trying to own the server market, which is already well established. So one of the things that you do is, if you understand where the market is going to go, rather than concentrating on where it is today, you attack that space. And the longer you leave that space, then the more money you have to put in to try to capture your share, because it's already developed. So if we now look at something like infrastructure, it was pretty clear in 1966 from Douglas Parker's book that ultimately infrastructure would head to the state of being more of a utility. It was just more of a question of when it was going to happen, when the conditions were right. And that sort of came together with the internet and then Amazon doing later on launching services like EC2 S3. Now, you've got a change in that industry occurring. Fortunately, there's all sorts of games that you can play against incumbents in that space. You can try and create a competitive market of providers, which is what OpenStack is doing. Or if you happen to believe that your competitor has some sort of bottleneck, such as if Amazon has a bottleneck buying up enough land to meet up with its rapid growth of, 200% a year, then you can initiate a price war to force more demand and beyond their ability to grow, and naturally cause fragmentation. And so that's why it was interesting that Google Compute Engine basically, for the same amount of money, you get double the capacity which Amazon is offering. So they're initiating a price war. But in order to play these games, you've got to do it at scale. I mean, it was a difference in, say, 2007. The amount of money that you needed to make a dent in that market was a lot less. If you're coming into the market today, I mean, with the players in there and the sums of money that they're investing, if you want to make a dent in that market, you've got to be considering, hundreds and hundreds of millions of investment. Now, will the industry consolidate to a single sources? Well, there's natural limits, or there can be natural limits on efficiency. So it's not necessarily true that a single data center, when it goes beyond 200,000 servers, doesn't have a sort of tailing off point where it is there is a limit to efficiency. So it's all about the games you can play and your willingness to invest sums of money. And if you were, say, a hardware provider, a company like Dell or HP, obviously you wouldn't want a situation where in the future there are a couple of big providers and you're just selling to those big providers' hardware, because that puts you in an extremely weak supplier position. So naturally your interest would be to try to fragment the market by creating a price war, increasing demand beyond the growth of an individual, and encouraging multiple other providers to set up. Whether they actually play those games and realize, the dangers is another question. So we shouldn't assume that commoditization just leads to centralization. It depends upon also the games that people play and other economic factors. If you want to get into the space today, you are talking significant sums of money. And that wasn't the case in 2006, but certainly today, you're talking huge amounts if you want to make a dent in that space. So yes, the conditions and change, the environment changes, and you have to adjust to that. Does that make sense?
Makes perfect sense. Absolutely.
Super. Yeah, no, it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see. For example, you mentioned HP, and we know HP is getting into hosting their own cloud. Yeah, well, how they'll sort of play with that, because it's obviously, like you said, as a cloud provider, if they were just a cloud provider, you've got certain economics that you're trying to play to. But in their case, they're probably trying to play both ends of the of the game in terms of, like you said, they don't want to be stuck in a situation where, from a supplier's perspective, their customers are dictating all the prices and you know, being able to you know, sort of drive their margins down. So
absolutely.
Yeah. So speaking of that sort of situation, and I'm gonna tiptoe around this a little bit because Aaron and I have some relationships with VMware that we prefer not to get fired over. But you mentioned in a recent blog just a couple of weeks ago that, you know, if you were running the show, you know, watching the new VMware leadership changes, that you'd create, you know, you'd suggest to VMware to create a commodity open source cloud offering, really take advantage of what they've done with Cloud Foundry, get into this space for infrastructure as a service. And, you know, one of the details you had in there was you suggested they use CloudStack as sort of the infrastructure portion. I'm curious about that, but I'm also curious about, you know, maybe why it wouldn't be OpenStack, because, you know, their new relationship with Nicira, and, you know, you've been outspoken about OpenStack. Why might somebody go one way versus the other? And then sort of secondarily, without getting too long in the tooth, can you talk for a bit about, you know, how that might impact, you know, just APIs? There's been lots of talk about trying to commoditize and differentiate around APIs. How does that all play together for somebody who might be getting into this game like a VMware?
Okay, so a number of very, very interesting questions. First of all, I'm a great fan of OpenStack. I don't necessarily agree with all the sort of plays and moves that it's making, but I, in general, its goal of trying to create a competitive market of multiple providers so that customers can easily switch between them is something which is extremely beneficial to the wider market. So I'm a great fan of OpenStack. Let me talk a little bit about VMware, first of all, and what I would do. This, when it comes to dealing with how you play strategic games in the market, you need to really clearly understand what is your value chain, the components in your value chain, and what the state of evolution of each of those components are. And the reason for this is that some of those components may be barriers to entry into your space. Some of those components may be commoditizing. Some of them you can commoditize to your advantage and enable new higher order systems to occur and exploit that. If you don't understand, you know, your value chain and the state of evolution of the components, it's very difficult to play games. Now, if we take somebody like VMware, and VMware obviously owned by EMC, and I view EMC as being very, very smart. And I view that because of the games that I believe that they've played in the past. VMware fundamentally, you know, you've got hypervisor technology and the technology related to that. And obviously that market is being hit by open source technologies trying to commoditize that market even further. And also companies like Amazon and others providing infrastructure as a service. So you can expect that particular business area will over time get disrupted, head towards much more service-based technology and open technology. So you've got a problem there. If you're somebody like VMware, you've got this huge revenue stream in that space. How do you deal with that, particularly because your success at selling it will create huge inertia to change. I mean, there'll be forces inside which will deny that this world is going to change. So a number of different things you can do. So one thing I did was back in 2009, I made a prediction that VMware would do a platform play, and it would be an open source platform play. Because what you're doing there is you're pushing yourself up the value chain. So it's not just concentrating on the infrastructure layer. You're now looking at higher order systems, which will build on top of multiple different infrastructure providers. And there's all sorts of business models you can gain around that if you get a platform well spread, from insurance, exchange, brokerages, management tools, all sorts of different things. So when Cloud Foundry came along a year and a half later or whatever it was, I thought that was a really, really smart thing to be doing. I'm glad to hear of its growing success. But that still gives you the issue of this past industry. And, of course, you don't want to deny yourself the ability to play in that commodity space. So the other part of the prediction that I made was that they would look at monetizing Hypervisor business at the top of the market, probably through IPO or some vehicle like VC. And what I say in the prediction at that time that have subsequently put down was I thought they would come back with an infrastructure-based play around commodity services. And so I was particularly interested that they acquired Nicira recently, that we've heard about Project Zephyr. So they're not against the idea of being a service provider. And naturally, that's going to create some conflict between their existing business and their channel partners. So that's a useful tool if you are going to separate the two and do some sort of IPO. And a lot of their acquisition seems to have been, you know, further up the stack, so much more in the platform space and in the consumer space. And lastly, I suppose it's the movement of Paul Moritz to strategist for AMC. I mean, a lot of companies, people view that as a sort of as a sideways backwards step, but I've always seen EMC as being, you know, very smart in its strategic play. So that's why I take the view that I suspect that we'll see, and I have no information to confirm this one way or another, it's just my opinion, that we'll see a separation between the old Hypervisor business, probably through some sort of IPO. VMware getting into being a service provider on a commodity basis, and the continued growth of Cloud Foundry. Now, when it comes to choosing what technologies you would use, well, you could go for OpenStack. OpenStack is interesting because when it comes to APIs, you don't care about APIs. No one's ever been able to open an API. There's all sorts of precedent for this. And in fact, you don't want to differentiate on APIs because fundamentally you're playing an ecosystem game. So you want to be able to co-opt as much of the biggest gorilla that's out there. And the biggest gorilla is Amazon. And so there's no value in terms of differentiation. So OpenStack's interesting because whilst they do provide EC2 S3 APIs, there's always been this sort of backstory about differentiation. And of course, there's lots of people involved in that as well. If you were going to choose off the two technologies, CloudStack or OpenStack, I mean, if it was a company like VMware, the size of VMware and the experience it could bring, it could support either. I personally just took, if I was making the stab, I'd probably do something like use CloudStack, which is in the Apache Software Foundation, buy a company like Bashu, who provides React CS, which provides an S3 compatibility layer. You've got Nicira. You could make a strong play around those three. You could make a play around OpenStack as well. It's horses for courses, really. I mean, you could choose either, but I had to put something down, and I'll choose. If I was playing, I'd go CloudStack.
Gotcha. Well, and like you said, there's always sort of backstories as to what's going on, and knowing where OpenStack is and its relationship with Rackspace, even with the foundations and all. I mean, there's like you said, there's always going to be inertia to at least mentally, think you need to differentiate from somebody else. But like you said, it really comes back to, do you want to fragment a platform? Do you want to fragment a set of developers? And does that really play itself out as differentiation or not?
Mm-hmm. So, you could go with either. I would, that was the purpose of this post, was where would I play if I was VMware, and I would attack an infrastructure as a service on a commodity basis. I'd probably take somebody like Bashu, open source React CS, use Cloud Foundry, which has been open sourced by Citrix, use NYSERA and build it around that basis. You could equally decide that the community is so large around OpenStack, it makes more sense to go with OpenStack. It really is a gut-filled choice at that point in time.
Yeah, and that makes sense. It makes sense.
And Simon, let me ask you this. So with either one, though, VMware has typically been really in the enterprise space historically and really selling to large enterprises. What is the tipping point or the factors that have to come in play, in your opinion, for VMware to get out of the existing business or really expand cloud computing into the enterprise above and beyond their existing product portfolio? You're talking about all of these new products. So sure. Paint a little bit of a picture about how VMware grows these new technologies into the enterprise.
Well, I can't speak for VMware. I don't know.
Of course.
I have absolutely no idea and no information. I can just tell you what is my opinion of the game, and that is all. So, so one of the things about cloud is that this shift towards utility services, as I've said beforehand, you also get co-evolution of practice. And so what happens is people try to take old applications designed for best practice in the product world. They put them on the cloud and, you know, Amazon has downtime and they run around saying, oh, the end of cloud is nigh. What a disaster. But then, of course, you get people realizing that architectural practices have to co-evolve as well. And so companies like Netflix with distributed systems designed for failure and the use of things like chaos engines, or in their case, chaos monkey, where you're introducing continuous failure in order to ensure the system is resilient. Now, what happens is, during this transitional time, we've seen a lot of talk about hybrid models. And people talk about hybrid in terms of public and private. And there are a number of other causes of inertia to change, concerns about suppliers, locking, etc. And so people have focused on this public-private division. But over time, you should expect that to change to more public-public provision. So we're again talking about hybrid model, but this hybrid model is one where we're combining multiple public providers together. And now you've got Amazon and you've got people like Google with Google Compute Engine in the space. This becomes ever more possible. So yes, a lot of enterprises will have inertia to change because of their applications built on past best practice and the cost involved with that. And as a result of which, you'll see a lot of talk, and this is one of the things we identified at Ubuntu would happen, about private clouds and the importance of private clouds being as similar to past data centers as much as possible. So lots of focus on enterprise class machines, SLAs, etc. But over time, that will change. Over time, that will change and become niche. So if you own a hypervisor business in that space, and if I was running that game, what you'd want to do is monetize it through an IPO or something like that, that part of the business at the top of the market, when all the analysts are running around shouting that your technology is the future of cloud, before that transition has occurred. If you leave it too long, and the hybrid model of public-public starts to dominate, then it becomes more difficult.
Sure. And I guess to kind of add to that slightly too is, at times I feel like we kind of all follow this industry we want to call cloud computing, but at times we get a little caught up in technology for technology's sake. Mm-hmm. And what I see happening a lot of times in enterprise customers I talk to today is, at the end of the day, if there is an application architecture switch that has to happen, well, they're going to do it on a time frame when that application comes due for a major upgrade. And that isn't necessarily a fast cycle. There's a lot of enterprises out there that applications are on a 10-year plus cycle.
Sure.
And at the end of the day, that application either generates revenue or any kind of modifications to it generate expenses to the business. And most enterprises aren't going to upgrade just for the sake of upgrading.
No, I completely agree. agree. But what you have to remember is, as a result of commoditization, the activity becomes more efficient, but you also gain benefits in terms of the ability to build new higher order systems more quickly, and the new higher order systems is where the value is. So if you're competing against somebody who is working in that frame, not only will they be more efficient than you, they'll be more agile than you and more able to extract value from these new higher order systems than you can. And those are a powerful set of forces. And when you start to think about, Amazon released an archiving service here and a couple of days ago, Glacier, which I think was something like $120 per year per gigabyte at 11 nines. Was the level of resilience, which is incredibly cheap. And then you start to compare it against the internal cost of building your own systems. I mean, these can be significant sums of money. But you're right. There is a development cycle for large-scale applications, so we shouldn't expect this to occur overnight. It doesn't. But this world has already been building since 2006, 2007, so we're already a good 5 years into this process. So you should expect it, a lot of this change to occur over the next 5 years, possibly 10 years at tops.
Yeah, and Aaron, I think, one of the things that I think Simon is sort of pointing out, and we've talked about this a couple of times with folks like Stratus and RightScale, and, there's going to be a layer even for the enterprise to start putting some tools, some operations, or really I think what you've been talking about is sort of the new form of best practices or process to get them the ability to leverage multiple clouds, right? Multiple public clouds.
Yep.
Look at them as resources and marketplaces for cost, for geography, for in some cases specialized performance or specialized archiving. So that, I think that'll be an interesting sort of next set of vendors and tools that people will have to start kind of making themselves available or at least knowledgeable about.
Mm-hmm.
So, Simon, let me ask you one last question because we're sort of, getting towards wrapping up the show. You made an interesting comment, and this keeps coming back, this idea of, innovation cycles and really the overall cycles. But you made a comment, it's maybe been a year or so ago, where when Apple was, and they still are, stock was way up and everybody was singing their praises and they were the most, valuable company in the world according to the stock market, you sort of took a contrarian approach that said you sort of predict they'll crumble. And I think a lot of it was driven by, you said, their culture is fundamentally built on constant innovation, and that's almost impossible to sustain.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that, take Apple out of the picture, is that something for a lot of technology companies, is that something they can transition over time from being, kind of innovation or differentiation as being their driver to these new stages, commodity, or do you see it as something that, like you said, it runs in parallel, but you almost have to break the company up so you can take this human inertia out of the decision-making process?
There are ways of organizing and structuring companies to cope with that inertia. To change. Unfortunately, those particular methods, there's not enough data to conclusively say. There's enough to say it works in these four or five examples that I know of, but not enough to say it is widely applicable. However, and let's go back to the prediction about Amazon. Apple. The issue with Apple is it boils down to, again, examining value chain and the state of evolution, is by not open sourcing iOS, they enable Google to play the Android game against them and put them in competition with an ecosystem. And this is exactly what Google has done. And generally, most companies who've found themselves competing against an ecosystem of other companies have been forced to push towards the even more extremely to the constant innovation or genesis of new activities. And unfortunately, that's always uncertain. It's inherently uncertain, and eventually luck runs out with you. So there are a number of games you can play to counter that in terms of buying up bits of the supply chain, the use of patents, etc. And those things are things that we've seen Apple do. But I took the view that they're actually in a difficult position because of the threat now from Android, and it's a question of time. Now, there are ways of playing the game. So for example, the use of ecosystem models, which are extremely powerful. So if you take something like Amazon, we've talked about them, so I'll pick on them again. The ecosystem game is fundamentally what you do is you provide commodity services to others, and you enable an ecosystem of other companies to build on top of your services. So you enable a platform of, and other companies to build on top of that. And then what happens is other companies, because you've reduced the cost of failure through provision of utility services, more easily innovate as in create new activities. And because they're consuming your APIs, you can see those activities diffuse. And then what you do is, so you leverage that ecosystem to spot the new trends as they diffuse, you can copy or acquire them. The difference is just one of messaging. And once you've copied or acquired, you can provide commodity services. So, for example, Amazon comes out with EC2 S3, people do big data systems, Amazon comes out with Elastic MapReduce, etc. And, of course, every time Amazon does this, people run around confusing Ashboss, say, declaring that they're eating their own ecosystem. But you do that in order to provide those component services, in order to grow that ecosystem faster. And the key about this is that what's happening is the rate of innovation, which actually a lot is being done by other people, the rate of customer focus or responsiveness, which in fact you're leveraging the ecosystem to spot the patterns which diffuse the matter, and your rate of efficiency, you're focusing on commodity service, all increase with the size of the ecosystem itself. And in fact, there used to be, I think it was Porter's competitive advantage, you could do one of those three things. Well, you can simultaneously do all three at the same time and grow it as close to linear as possible with the size of the ecosystem. And the size of the ecosystem grows super linearly with the size of the company. And so the net effect of this is that you end up with a company which appears to be highly innovative, highly customer-focused, highly efficient, and increasingly so as the company gets physically larger. And that's pretty novel. We normally associate, you know, large companies as becoming less of one of those. But this is a case where potentially, and it seems to be what is happening, is as the company grows, it becomes more of all three of those simultaneously at the same time. So there are all sorts of ways and means and techniques of playing the game. I think that Apple made a mistake with not open sourcing iOS. I didn't think it needed to keep it. And that enabled an ecosystem of other companies driven by Google to form around Android. And I think that is the threat and the danger for Apple, and that it naturally pushed itself towards more, a focus on the genesis of new activities. Mm-hmm. But I made this prediction when Steve Jobs was in charge. Cook's now in charge, and Cook's obviously shown in the past he has great experience and skills in the whole area of supply chain. So I've taken a view that things might actually balance themselves a little bit more. I'm still watching what happens on that. It was great. A great loss with Steve Jobs passing away, but my prediction was made well before that, and it was based upon Steve driving the company in that particular direction.
Gotcha. Well, listen, Aaron, a lot of stuff to process. Very, very good discussion today, Simon. Thank you so much for the time.
Pleasure.
I think, Aaron, I think we're out of time for this week. You want to take us home?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are out of time for this week. So Simon, where can everyone follow you and find out more information about your research and everything you've got going on?
Well, you can find me on Twitter as Swardley, S-W-A-R-D-L-E-Y, or you can just type Simon Wardley into Google and you'll find my blog and usually videos with kittens and guns and kittens and tanks from various presentations around the world. I mean, I generally speak at a lot of open source conferences. The research that I do is private research for the clients of the Leading Edge Forum. You can find the website on online as well. It's edf.cse.com.
Perfect. All right. So if you like the show, please tell a friend or leave us a review on iTunes. And you can follow us on Twitter at thecloudcastnet or on the web at thecloudcast.net, where you'll find links to our Facebook page, our YouTube channel, links to the show and show notes, as well as how to listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn. And so for this week, thanks for listening, everyone.